How are your pruning skills? If you need a little advice, you're in luck because we have an expert with us today. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and I'm filling in for Larry today on Garden Talk. Our guest is David Stevens. He is the curator of the Longenecker Horticultural Gardens. It's the home of the woody plant collection at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Arboretum. Are you thinking about doing some pruning? Well, what questions do you have? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Or you can post a picture, comment, or question on our Facebook page. Just look for The Larry Mueller Show. And David assures me he can answer vegetable questions and all kinds of other gardening questions. So don't be afraid if you don't have a pruning question. So, David, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, Jill, it is absolutely my pleasure. And first, I want to say what an honor it is to sit in the same seat as former colleagues and what I consider natural resource luminaries such as Scott Craven, Phil Pelletieri, and last but not least, the click and clack of vegetables, Irwin Goldman and Jim Nemes.
Yes, we love having all of those people on. So, you know, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Longenecker Horticultural Gardens over at the Arboretum?
Sure. It's kind of an odd name. If you Google it, you'll see we're the only horticultural garden really in the world. So Longenecker Horticultural Gardens is named for the first curator of the living collection of the Arboretum, as well. He was also the original executive director of the Arboretum alongside Aldo Leopold. What it is a collection of trees that are living, if you will, right? Similar to a museum. There is a dead plant thing, which is called a herbarium, and there's a curator of that, Hugh Iltis, a very well-known international curator of our herbarium here on campus, just died in the last 2 weeks. So a very sad thing. I was lucky enough to take classes with him. So Longenecker Horticulture Gardens was named in honor of G. William Longenecker slightly before his death. But what it truly is a living collection. We have roughly 5,000 different taxa, and we can talk about that at a different time, or specimens made up of 2,500 different types of taxa. So distinct, unique, whether it's a cultivar, a species, or a subspecies.
Okay.
So we are the largest collection of that sort in the state of Wisconsin, and one of the largest and most renowned in the upper Midwest.
And how big is it?
We are roughly 38 acres of the living collection, and of course the Arboretum itself is 1,200 acres, plus an additional 500 acres off-site, and we can talk about that as well.
Sure. Now, you've just, actually, this is a fairly new job for you. You came in 2015.
I did.
What's been your biggest challenge so far?
Boy, there's a lot there. So the biggest is filling the shoes of my mentor, my friend, and really a father figure to me, Professor Ed Hasselkiss.
Okay.
I came here 26 years ago to get my master's degree with Professor Ed, as we know him. Ed had over 3,000 students during his time there, and I was his 44th of his 45th master's students. So to fill his shoes, and he's got large shoes and long legs, so I'm trying to follow through on his legacy.
Okay. And do you have plans for 2017?
Oh, I've got plans, and you'll have to bring me back for a whole nother talk.
Because, well, quickly, what are some of the highlights?
Well, some of the highlights is we are finally replacing the antiquated fence, barbed wire fence, that's along Arboretum Drive that separates the living collection from the drive. And to tell you the truth, the reason it's still there is occasionally people think they can drive through the collection.
Oh.
So we're in the process of starting to rebuild that. We don't, as you know, the university funding, state, etc. So we're looking for donors to help us do that. We've secured some funding for that, and we'll start to make that fence. That fence will emulate the stonework at the entrances.
Oh, yes,
there.
That nice sign.
Mm-hmm. Yep, so, and it will go along, it will also have wood in there as well. So it'll be more of an organic architecture thing that will feed into the landscape
okay.
and not dominate it.
Excuse me. Well, you know, with all those trees and shrubs there, I'm imagining that you have an awful lot of pruning to do every year. How do you know when a plant needs to have pruning done?
Sure. First, I want to do a shout out to my head horticulturalist, Stephen James Nystrand, who worked for 3 years here on campus as a pruner. I go to him when I really have difficulty, and if we ever do this again, I will bring him along with me.
Uh-huh.
So I look to Stephen, but we both look for things that are well known. So included branch angles, broken branches, things that are going to be an issue for the tree down the road.
Okay. What are some common mistakes that you think that gardeners who really don't do this make?
Yeah. So the biggest mistake is A, not pruning. And B, pruning what they call a flush cut.
Okay.
So a flush cut is you go right up to the bark, and that will not heal over. So people don't realize that trees and shrubs do not heal as we do. So if we cut ourselves, we put new cells, in the same area with a tree or shrub. It's got to basically cordon that off or callus it over and keep that inside, so that wound stays with the tree its entire life.
Yes, and we can't see the picture on the radio. So he showed me a beautiful picture, everybody.
But I want to tell you that a gentleman named Alex Shigo, he is the one who came up with the concept that there is a way to prune, and you're looking at specific areas of the tree. And I can, after we're done here, I think we could put a few things of Shigo's up there. He changed everything and realized that wasn't till about 1985 that he published that kind of stuff.
Okay, because I know a lot of people, and we've gotten calls before, when someone prunes something and you've got that open wound on the tree, are you supposed to do anything or just let nature take its course?
Right. Back in the day, they used to recommend that we would put a tar on that. And what we've discovered, really, through Shigo's work, is that wound dressings, what they do is they don't really keep the insects and diseases out. They keep moisture in. So they actually encourage rot. So the only time at this stage in the game we say you should put a wound dressing on is if we're pruning something like an oak or nowadays a ash, and we're worried about that wound encouraging insects that are going to bring diseases such as emerald ash borer,
insects,
oak wilt,
right?
Things of that Dutch elm disease as well.
Sure. Well, you know what? We do have a couple of open lines. So if anybody has any questions for David, our number is 1-800-642-1234. So, call us with your gardening questions. Let's go to the phones right now. Mark in Dubuque has a question about pruning. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
What's your question?
Okay, I've got a large oak tree in the front of my yard, and this past early June, it just started dropping leaves like crazy. You know, it was fully leafed out, and by the end of July, it was totally leafless. So, thinking for some reason why it had died, in late August or September, it started getting some green leaves just on the main trunk of the tree. Wondering if there's a chance that there's going to be some life there. Is it something I just got to get down?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I'll try to answer it as best as I can, but the person really to talk to is Brian Huddleston here on campus in charge of our plant disease diagnostic lab. He'll give you the exact reason. You can send in a sample for that. There's a few different things that go on that cause early defoliation, one of them being we had that odd late frost that actually took out a lot of apple blossoms, but it also damaged the early stages of leaf development. So that could have been it. There's a few other things, one called Bob. I don't know if you know the specific. So bur oak blight. I don't know if you know the specific species, if you have a bur oak, if you have a red oak, if you have a white oak.
Do you know, Mark?
I do not know.
Does it have pointy leaf tips, or is it
rounded?
pointy.
So you're in the red oak family, so you could have a red oak, you could have a pin oak, things of that nature. So the fact that it re-leafed out makes me think that, no, you don't have an issue. The way you can go out and tell if your tree is alive, find the a branch you can reach, and with your fingernail, you simply are going to scrape back the outer bark, and if you see green under that, and that'll be the cambial tissue, your tree is alive. If it is brown, then your tree is probably not in the greatest shape. And in that case, I would get a trained arborist out there. They can tell you what needs to be done with it, and they can take the tree down effectively and safely if need be.
Okay, well, good luck with that, Mark. Hopefully it's going to be okay. Let's go to Sherry and Rowie. Hi, Sherry. What's your question?
I received a, they call it a shrimp tree. I don't know if it's, well, I know that I brought it in for the winter, but it seems to be losing leaves all the time, and then it seems like I'm having to water it every other day. And the shrimp, the flower, they call the shrimp part, it hasn't done that. Do I need to repot that, or what am I doing wrong?
Is that generally a house plant, Sherry, or...?
I don't know. My father passed away in August, and we received it as flowers for the at the wake,
okay.
And I want to keep it, and I don't know what to do with it.
Okay, David, what do you...
Sure. Well, what you've got there is a native to Guatemala and Honduras, so it's native to Central America. So it's not going to do well outside this time of year, obviously.
Yes.
You can put it outside in the summer and then bring it in the winter. So what's going on? You've got low humidity in the house, and the plant's probably gotten kind of large. So the fact that you're constantly having to water it, you're losing a lot of water through transpiration. So if you want to keep it, I would certainly recommend putting it in a bigger pot, or just realize you're going to have to water it very often.
Okay, and make sure you don't make that pot too big, Sherry. That's always a big mistake that people make. Wasn't it an inch bigger, I think, is what they usually recommend. So, okay, Sherry, well, good luck. I hope you can keep that shrimp tree. Let's go to Ray in Rhinelander. Hi, Ray. What's your question?
Oh, hi. This is for Dave. Do I have the name right?
Yes, David.
David. I respect your expertise. I'm really glad we have people like you that hung in there all these years to help other people and educate them in all aspects of what you're talking about here. I want to thank you for that first.
Well, thank you for that compliment.
Well, you deserve it. Secondly, I have a unique situation. I have two oak trees that have curled around each other and fused together. Their diameters are about maybe an inch. Well, when I was doing some cutting and pruning, I grazed the bottom part of one of these two trees, and it cut into the diameter about maybe not quite a third, a quarter of it. Now, in the past, I have taken balsam sap and put them in tree wounds, and that has successfully helped to cover it up, keep it from infections, et cetera, et cetera. This happened this fall. Which I was not glad it happened, but I was glad it happened in the fall. In the spring, it probably would have been better because it could have bled out. But what would you suggest I do to save this small diameter oak that's fused with another one? Because it's a very unique natural sculpture. I know I'm going on here. I'll get to the point.
All right,
I do the same thing. I love this, Dave.
Okay.
Well, you know, there's natural nature sculptures that you want to preserve that do unique and bizarre things, and this is one of them.
Sure.
So,
well,
anyways, I will stop talking. I'll let you finish and
thank
let you,
Ray.
Tell me how to
sure.
save that tree.
Yeah, we
sure.
appreciate your enthusiasm.
The first thing to tell you is that what you've got there, people have been doing for eons. So the Chinese first, then the French are very well known for intermingling, if you will, the same species. So they'll actually make natural grafts. Your other thing you're doing is phenomenal. By using spruce sap, that's a totally different reality than using those wound dressings. So the sap that's coming out of a pine or a spruce or a fir, when they get wounded, is their natural way of keeping diseases away. So it's not just healing it, if you will, or keeping it secluded. It does have natural chemicals in there that are actually detrimental to fungus and bacteria. So phenomenal. So what I'm going to tell you as far as how to save it, I think everything's good. Just go ahead and send me a picture and my email, and I think Jill can put it up there. I only have one email. I don't do Google. I don't do Facebook. Shoot it to me at dstevens, D-S-T-E-V-E-N-S. I've been here long enough that I'm the only D Stevens, so it's not 1, 2, 3, or 8, at WISC, right, W-I-S-C, dot E-D-U. And I will get back to you probably before the weekend's out and tell you yay, nay. And if I can't answer that, I find somebody who can.
Okay. Well, good luck, Ray. And hopefully you can get that to David. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. Our guest is David Stevens. He is the curator of the Longenecker Horticultural Gardens at the UW-Madison Arboretum. What questions do you have about trees, woody ornamentals, vegetables? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk at WPR.org. On Monday, we talk with an eyeglass specialist about the long-term effect of blue light on our vision. And we're also going to speak with a researcher who is working with cancer patients to help them integrate exercise into their lives. Lots coming up, so hope you can join us then. Right now, we're talking with David Stevens. And David, you're going to be presenting at a UW Extension Master Gardener Conference coming up. What can you tell us about that?
Well, what I can tell you about that is, first and foremost, the only reason they asked me is because my brilliant and beautiful wife of over 22 and a half years, Jane Holly Stevens, is the keynote speaker there. So she and I own a farm out by Baraboo, certified organic, for the last 26 years. But she herself runs Four Elements Organic Herbals. If you're not familiar with it, go ahead and Google that. And that's kind of why I'm there. I was completely unfamiliar with this, but I thought, hey, be a great date and getaway for us. So what I can tell you, it's called Garden Visions. It's going to be on January 20th and 21st in Wausau, Wisconsin. So they've got a phenomenal website on that as well. So I would highly recommend that you go ahead and Google that. Garden Visions 2017, Wausau. And it'll come right up.
Yeah, and the actual website, if you want to be exact, is gardenvisions.info. So if maybe Brandy can put that up on our Facebook page, and we put a link up there to that so you can go. And I believe you can pre-register or you can do walk-in, although if you walk in, you don't get lunch. So I highly recommend you register beforehand.
And I'll tell you, I don't get the dinner, even though my wife's the keynote. I got to pay for it. So
it
they need some.
Really
they need money
good.
As well.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds really interesting. They have all kinds of great topics that they're going to be discussing. They've got, in fact, some of our guests have been here. Neil DeBole is going to be there, and Aaron LaFave from the UW Extension will be there. I'm talking about roses and wildlife control, rock garden. So anyway, we'll hopefully that people can go see that, and hopefully they will get something out of it. In the meantime, we've got a number of calls waiting, but we did have one caller who couldn't hold, and he asked if it's too late to prune a lilac bush right now. And if it is, what is the best time?
So I'll let you know, the absolute best time to do the lilac, what we call the French hybrids, things of this nature. So Syringa vulgaris. Vulgaris means common. And that's the one we all grew up with. Best time to prune it is right after it flowers, because it's starting to set its flowers almost right after that. So that's if you want the most robust flower display. But in general, the best time to prune all woody plants is this time of year. So you've got no diseases, insects that we had talked about to come in there. They have the longest time to go ahead and heal back up. If we had our druthers and we could do it all at once, we would do it in the late winter, but winter itself is the best time to do it.
And you can see it better too, right? I mean, if you're doing for looks.
Yeah, not only can you see it better, but for people like myself who have to deal with large-scale pruning material afterwards, you have no leaves to deal with. So you have a lot less material to handle.
That's a plus. And I mean, speaking of pruning, so I put a picture of somebody up in a tree on our Facebook page keep people's attention. It was me. And we've had a number of professionals remark that this person is not doing things correctly. So do you want to address that a little bit, David, as far as safety precautions for trimming in a tree?
Certainly. I would say if you're up in a tree like the guy there, unless you're a trained arborist, and if it was a trained arborist, we'd know immediately because he'd be tethered in there. Do not climb up a tree and cut on it. Use a ladder if you must. I don't really recommend that either. Best to get a pole saw that telescopes.
So you can stay on the ground.
Stay on the ground, and they also make pruners that can telescope. So that's the way to go. If you need to get up in a tree like that, I'm not a trained arborist. I can't go up there. Call a trained arborist. We have a phenomenal Wisconsin Arborist Association, AAWAA. I know a lot of those folks, including the current president, phenomenal gentleman, and they are the people who can do that, and you won't see them up there without being tethered.
That's right. So, see, I did that on purpose. Not really, but I'm saying I did. Let's go to the phones. Darlene in Viola. Hi, Darlene. What's your question?
Yes. I have a number of fruit trees that I have been very successfully pruning for the last 20 years. However, I have one problem child, and it is a Cortland tree. I was told that it was a dwarf when I purchased it, but it appears to me that it is a semi-dwarf. The growth on it is extremely aggressive, and I know about pruning, not to prune too much at any one time. It just grows out so differently than all of my other apple trees. The vertical shoots on the very top of the tree are just crazy, and it gets so thick with branches in the interior of the tree that it just blocks so much of the sunlight from the apples.
Okay,
and
all right.
What
would
you suggest?
What do you think, David?
Sure. First thing I'm going to say, I've been through Viola numerous times. You're out in the Kickapoo there, perfect area for growing apples. So you've got that air drainage of the hills, Gay's Mills. That's why there's so many apple trees. So I can tell right away you know what you're doing. And for people who don't know, when you go to a garden center or do it online, you can order the same type of apple variety, if you will, cultivar we call them, in dwarf, semi-dwarf, or standard. So you were smart enough, you knew that you didn't want it to get too big, you didn't want a standard, but you didn't want to pay the extra cost to get the dwarf. Plus, the reality is sometimes those dwarfing rootstocks, those were developed in England. The most well-known are the Malling series, but that's for another talk. It sounds to me like you're right. You got probably a standard, and I'm fearful from what you're saying that possibly the rootstock, right? So these are grafted. So all Cortlands came from one chance Cortland seedling. Apples are not true from seed, like, you know, think of them. Anyway, we can't think of them as like a hybrid vegetable seed. We can't save the seed from that. We get
something else, right?
So the first thing is if you allow that rootstock to go, and it's an easy thing to do, and it's going to be growing like gangbusters. So again, if you want to shoot me a picture of that to that same to my same email, and Jill, I think, will have that up after this, I will take a look at it. Again, my head horticulturalist, Stephen James Nystrand, knows a lot more about apples than I even, although I got my degree, my undergraduate degree at Virginia Tech, which is in the Appalachians, a huge apple-growing area, and my undergraduate degree was in vegetable and fruit production. So Stephen and I will take a look at it, and we'll get right back to you and tell you what we think, if it's a lost cause or not.
Okay, well, good luck, Darlene. Please contact David. Now, speaking of fruit trees, let's go to Dan in Burlington. Hi, Dan.
Hi, John and David. Thanks for the show.
You bet. What's your question?
I apologize in advance. I tuned in just as you were talking about tree wounds.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry if this is a redundant question, but I have a small group of young trees I planted the October before last. They're about 12 feet tall now, pears and apples, and the deer found them and just had a great old time rubbing on them and eating the cambium, whatever they were doing. It's kind of devastating. I, you know, none of them are rubbed off all the way around. But are these going to be a loss? And is there anything I can do?
Yeah. So people don't know, the number one problem in the living collection at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum that we call the Longnecker Horticulture Garden are deer. The number one problem of oak regeneration in the entire state are deer. So we've got an overpopulation of deer. I love deer, too. I love watching them. I love hunting them. I love the venison that we get from them. The problem is they come in and they eat the buds, usually. So something like oak, they'll eat the buds because they're so nutritious year-round. Other things like your apple or evergreens, they'll come in this time of year when it's harder to find things that are so nutritious. Depending on how hard they hit it and how much they might have deformed it, I'll have to take a look at that picture. But we call the browse line on trees, and you go up north, you see an arborvitae, you'll see that they're usually eaten up 6 feet up. That's as high as deer can eat, right? So you usually get above that, you're okay. My previous job, I put in a lot of plantings for research, and right after planting them, we'd put a deer fence around there. And you can get a fairly cheap one. We're not talking metal these days. It's a plastic called Tenex. Look it up, Google that, C-Flex. And I can put it up. I put it up around our vegetables for us at home. Beets are the thing they go after, the vegetable. They'll find them whenever we plant them anywhere. And for years, we just do that crop, and we called it the beet corral. So that's going to be an issue with deer. Apples are a huge thing they like. So I'm going to tell you, if you want to continue to grow a little apple orchard, you're going to probably have to fence it. But to tell you if it's a total loss, just take a quick picture on your smartphone, if you've got it, on a digital camera, and just shoot it to me. And once again, I'll take a look at it. And if I don't know the answer, I'll get my head horticulturist, Stephen James Nystrand, in there to help me figure it out as well.
Okay. Next up, we've got Kim in Prairie du Sac. Hi, Kim. What
Hi.
Do you have for us?
I have in my front yard, it's the cornerstone of my yard, a huge flowering crab. It's huge. It's probably over 40 years old. Probably three main pieces that come off. The center is got, the center crotch of it is holding water. Is that going to rot? Am I going to have a big chunk split off? And overall, it's a huge tree, the circumference. Is it going to get too weighty and am I going to lose it? What do I need to be doing with it?
You bet. Let me do a few things here. So when we call it the circumference, my degrees are in horticulture. I worked in forestry for the previous 14 years. We call it DBH, diameter at breast height. What's breast height? It's 4.5 feet off the ground. So if a forester would come out, he wouldn't talk about circumference. He'd talk about DBH. That's that answer. The other one is yes. If it's holding water, it's telling me that there's a little bit of rot already. You might have lost a branch there, and there's a little hole. As we know, water encourages rot. So that's going to be your issue. You are correct. It's a matter of time. Could be 15 years. Could be next summer, depending on wind, a snow load, things of that nature, probably going to snap off. I'm going to tell you, my organic farm, Four Elements, I'm 20 minutes from you. I know how to get down to Sauk because my daughter played hockey there for over 15 years. So if you want to shoot me your address in my email, I'll actually swing by your place and look at it for you.
Well, that's awfully nice of you, David. You do house calls. But in that case, for places you can't go, is that a job for an arborist?
That's a job for an arborist, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's go to Carol in Wausau. Hi, Carol. What's your question?
Hi. I have apple trees that I have never trimmed, and I've probably had them 20 years. I would like, and I think you've answered a part of my question, when is the best time to trim them? Would be now, I'm assuming. And what my thoughts were, I would like to just lop off the top branches because they're getting too tall we can't get to the apples on the top. So can I just lop off the top branches, or is that going to harm the trees?
Is that a good idea, David?
That's a great idea for an apple. So when you go by apple orchards, you'll notice they've pruned them so they're horizontally branched. Apple trees just always want to go up, especially if they have a standard. The rule of thumb is not to take more than a third of the tree, they used to say, right, at a time. Now you're better off taking more like a quarter. But an apple tree that's that vigorous, I'd go ahead and whack it back. We do use that term to about a third of it. Again, do just Google pruning correctly. And again, Alex Shigo.
How's Google, that spelled, David?
Right. So that is A-L-E-X, like Alex, and then Shigo, S-H-I-G-O.
Okay.
Almost all library systems have his books, and you'll see there where he'll teach you about this branch collar.
Mm-hmm.
And so it'll prevent you from doing these flush cuts. That's the important thing. If you just whack it helter-skelter, you're probably going to do a flush cut, and you're going to have these wounds that are going to take your tree down over time. If you do it correct, as you'll see in Shigo's writings, and he's great with pictures, he's got you all the pictures. You do that correct, they'll heal right back over. And realize with a vigorous apple tree, you're probably going to, especially when it's been pruned like that, you're probably going to be taking a quarter to a third of that top growth back for a few years.
So is that going to affect how many apples she gets next year?
Well, that is, but that's, remember with apples, they have an issue where they normally do alternate year bearing. They bear a lot of fruit one year, they don't bear hardly anything the next year, and that's compounded by things we've had here. Winter of 2012 was a horrible one.
Mm-hmm.
This last year, late frosts can kill those. The reality in commercial apple growers, too many apples on the tree is a bad thing. It sucks too much energy, and they'll actually go out there, either shake them off or spray a chemical that will cause a certain number of the flowers or fruit to abort. So that's the issue. Another old-fashioned way I learned back in Virginia, if you're having problems with finding branches that are going horizontal, you can tie a string and out. You just don't tie a string. Look it up on how to tie something so you don't girdle it.
And weight it down.
Weight it down with a rock or a brick.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, let's go to Helen in Manitowoc. Hi, Helen. What's going on with your tree?
Well, I have a weeping, flowering cherry. It's an ornamental tree, obviously. Don't get any cherries on it. The birds eat all the blossoms, the little bitty birds, but they got to eat too. It has a big crack. A couple of years ago, we had a real cold winter, and like this year, and it's got a big crack. It's an inch wide. It doesn't go all the way to the base of the tree, but it starts up where the branches kind of come out of. And this happened a couple of years ago. I'm wondering if the tree is on its way out, or if there's something I can do, or if it's just normal that they get big cracks in their trunks.
Well, living in Wisconsin in the north, that's pretty common. We would call it in horticulture a frost crack. In forestry, would call it a seam. So if you were looking to take that as a saw log, that would be very detrimental because you've got a little seam of rot. In this case, from an ornamental standpoint, I wouldn't be that concerned until you start to see some dieback on the upper part of the tree. That's going to tell you, right? Crown dieback, we call it, the crown of the tree. That's going to tell you the tree's starting to go down. Cherries in general, especially where you are fairly short-lived if they're in the ornamental. So where you've got probably originated in Asia, I'm going to say Japan. So it didn't necessarily grow here like if you want to look at our black cherries. And even if you look at our black cherries, we're on the northern edge of their natural range. So when we think of them in forestry as being kind of snaky, in ornamental horticulture, we'd say they have a bad form or architecture. So I wouldn't be concerned about that. It was an odd winter. You got a frost crack. It's been happening for eons. The trees know how to deal with it. They'll actually go ahead and kind of heal over that.
So let nature take its course.
Right. And let the tree tell you when it's going down.
There you go. Steve, let's go to you. You are in Menominee Falls. What's up?
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for a great show. And I have a kind neighbor who asked me if I wanted his Honeycrisp apple tree from his backyard. He didn't want it anymore, so I said, of course, I'll take it. And I transplanted it last spring, sometime late May, and it took to my backyard. I thought it did well. It's probably 4 or 5 years old, and I noticed that at the bottom, it's probably, I'm thinking, 7 or 8 feet tall at this point, and I'm wondering about pruning off two lower limbs that are maybe 3 feet off the ground.
Is that a good idea?
That is a good idea, but first, I've got a story for you. I've got to give a shout-out to the University of Minnesota Arboretum. The curator there of the living collection is David Stevens' son. I'm David Stevens. Yes, I've met him. We're funny with that. People don't realize that that one was actually bred by the University of Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, and if you ever go up to their arboretum, you'll see they've got a lot fancier visitor center than we do, and a lot of that money came from the royalties of Honeycrisp. So realize, folks, when you go pay that top dollar for Honeycrisp, it's actually going right back to that university. So great, and you've got the hottest one on the market, so that's all good. Back to your question, absolutely. Prune off those lower limbs. Again, follow Shigo. Look him up. We are always pruning to get in there with a lawnmower. So the lower limbs, not going to hurt at all. They call it the scaffold, if you will. When it's young, we leave them to get more energy. But over time, we like to take them off, especially before they get too big in diameter. The bigger in diameter they are, the harder it is for the tree to, if you will, heal over it.
Makes sense. Smaller area. John emailed us. Now, he is a certified arborist in Duluth and the owner of a small orchard. He said that he noticed an abundance of disease on apple trees throughout the area, and he's done some research. He found it to be black rot and not fire blight. And he's wondering if you've noticed this at all, and will it eventually kill the branch or the stem? Well, he said it will actually eventually kill the branch or the stem, but it takes a while. Have you had any experiences with that?
I have indeed. Over the last 2 summers, we were extremely humid, especially last summer. Humidity is one of the things that fungus and disease need to grow. So if you came out to us, most of our crab apples, and we have the most up-to-date crab apple collection in the world, thanks to Professor Ed Hasselkiss. 200 different crab apples made up of roughly 150 different cultivars. Most of those were fine because Professor Ed would go out and things that had or had lost resistance, and I can talk on and on about how things lose resistance over time, he would take out of our collection. That's part of being a curator. You take a picture out that doesn't, talk to you anymore in a museum. We take trees out that have lost resistance or climate change has caused that to occur. So it was a horrible year. So hawthorns for us, something that doesn't have resistance, completely defoliated. Numerous other tree species, we saw early defoliation simply because of the excess humidity, not because of the rain per se, but because we had extra humidity. If we continue to have summers like that, then yes, your tree's probably going to go down slowly but surely. The reality, as you've probably seen, is that, wait an hour, weather's going to change. So let's hope for a drier, as far as humidity goes, next year. Still, we want the rains, okay? So not to worry so much yet. Again, if you really want to identify that, send it to Brian Huddleston here on campus. He will be able to give you the exact.
Okay. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network, and Larry's feeling much better, so he should be back with you on Monday. Our guest today is David Stevens. He is the curator of Longenecker Carticult Horticultural Gardens at the UW-Madison Arboretum. What questions do you have about trees or woody ornaments or gardening in general? Give us a call. We have a few open lines. The number is 1-800-642-1234, and you can always send an email to talk@wpr.org. Today at 2 on Science Friday, they're going to take a look at long-running experiments, including one that takes 140 years. And good news from the fight against malaria. A new vaccine candidate has made it through to early human trial. So far, it looks safe. Plus, what would you do if you had your own tractor beam? That sounds like fun. Thanks for being with us on Garden Talk. Our guest is David Stevens, and we're talking about pruning and all that other good stuff. So let's go right back to the phones, David. We've got John in Eau Claire with an unusual plant. John, what do you got?
Yeah, so I have 6 potted giant sequoias, and I bought them on Amazon. I thought it'd be a great practical joke for people in the future. But my question is, how likely is it that they would survive in this environment? Growing up in East Texas, Northeast Texas, we had a lot of petrified wood, and I was told that that was giant sequoia and that they had been prolific all over the United States. So I'm wondering if the climate has changed enough so that we can plant those in this local area.
Yeah, first off, where in East Texas are you from?
Near Tyler, Longview?
You betcha, Rose Capital there, Tyler. Met my wife at the Dallas Arboretum. That's where I kind of cut my teeth, too. So I've been out to Tyler quite a bit. To answer your question, yeah, they were native kind of around the world before the Ice Age, as were ginkgo, dawn redwood, some things of that nature. So the reality is that while we just know them in the Pacific Northwest and realize recently they changed the genus and now it's Sequoia dendron, just to make our life more difficult when we learn these types of Latin names, there's a big kind of, I won't say it a craze, but you Google that. People are growing them up in Michigan and in northern climates. The reality is we get a super harsh winter. Probably die back to the ground, and there's a good chance it'll stump sprout for you. So it'll survive, but you're not gonna see it become what you're used to out in the Pacific Northwest.
Okay, well, that will be interesting to see what happens with the climate and if we have some sequoias in years to come. Thank you for the call, John. Let's go to David in Harvard, Illinois. Hi, David. What can we help you with?
Hi, David and Jill. Thanks for taking my call. I bought some property, and the woman who owned it row planted pines, white pines, oaks, and cedars, and ash. All the ash are dead because of the emerald ash borer. But I got these pines and oaks about 15 years old that are about 10 feet from each other,
yep,
covering a 6-acre plot. I don't know how to handle this. It just seems like there's way too many plants choking out the oaks. You know, they're growing real straight and tall, you know, vegetation on the top, but really nothing on the bottom. I just don't know what I should do about it.
Well,
let me tell you what. So the other hat, as I had said, is forestry for me, almost 14 years there. So what they did was they planted out the hardwood, which is your oak, and that's what you want for saw timber down the road. It's much more valuable. They simply planted the pines as trainers. So a trainer means it is training that oak to go fast, upright, and straight, which is what we want in forestry. And it also is causing it to naturally prune off the lower limbs because it shades it. At 15 years, those trainers should be just whacked out. You just go right down the row, take out all the white pine. Then you would go through and select the highest quality oaks. What's the highest quality? That's up to you. In a forestry standpoint, we want the straightest and fastest growing. So again, in this case, I wouldn't get an arborist in there. Get your county forester in there. Okay, that's the DNR. Look up on the website. That's what they're paid to do. Right? And that's what they love to do and train to do. They'll come out, take a look at it, make a suggestion for you, and maybe even help you mark the trees to keep. But remember, you're going to want to take out all the pine. And that's why they planted them so close. Normally, you'd take out every other, every third, maybe in 5 years, then do the same in 10 years. And by the 15th year with oak, you're going to take all that out. What's happening now, it's suppressing, as you stated,
as you can probably see,
the growth of the oak. And they planted the oak real tight, too, so you had the ability to select. Okay. Does that make sense?
All right, David. Well, good luck with that. Let's go to Tom in Buffalo City. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Yes, hello. I've got a blue spruce tree that's kind of gotten out of hand. It's grown quite quickly, and now the tap is up near the power lines, and the girth of the tree has grown more than I'd like, where it's getting out into the alleyway. Is there any way to trim off, say, 5 feet from the top or 3 feet off around the girth of the tree?
Yeah, so what you've got is the state tree of Colorado, and it does grow here. We usually think of it not being surviving here for more than 30 or so years because Colorado's a drier, less humid climate. So when I tell you to remove the tree completely, realize that it was probably going to not live a lot longer. So it's the right tree in the right place. So if you want to go to Wisconsin, you know, your power company will have a website, and they're going to tell you the appropriate trees to plant under it. If you really want to plant a Colorado blue spruce, if that's your thing, there are many dwarf versions of it. So what you're talking about, you often, what times we see under power lines, is called topping. Look up Shigo again. Topping is one of the worst things you can do. So do not top the tree. You've just simply got the wrong one in the wrong place, and it wasn't going to last that much longer anyway.
So basically, he should probably look into getting that removed.
That would be an arborist there as well.
Okay, Tom. Thanks for calling with that. Let's go to Cole in Kenosha. Hi, Cole. What's your question?
Hi, I have a moonflower vine. It was at the house when we moved in. And the thing kind of takes over everything. It just grows up the porch and kills, like, other plants that are kind of growing around it. So I've been trying to get rid of it for the last couple years, and I was wondering if there's any advice on getting rid of it.
Sure.
Go right ahead.
If you're not, I have a certified organic farm. We've been certified 26 years, so chemicals are not my thing. But in your case, you're going to need to use a chemical. The ones that our restoration hotshots use is Garlon. So go to a garden center. You can look it up online. You don't have to buy the name brand. You're going to pay a lot for it. Look up the active chemical, Garlon 4. You're going to cut it to the ground, like you said, and then treat the stump. You don't have to treat the whole stump. You just have to treat that cambial tissue around it. So you're barely going to have any of that released into the environment. But that's what you're going to have to do.
Okay. Well, there you go, Cole. Let's go to Tom in Marinette City County. That's a county. Hi, Tom. What do you have?
What I have is an overgrown grandma orchard that hasn't been trimmed in probably 40 years, maybe.
Okay.
And I was wondering, where do I start?
Wow, that sounds like quite an undertaking.
Right. Where you're going to start is the top of the tree, because you're going to want to stop that growth up, 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 and up. Again, we used to say a third of the tree. Now we've pulled back. In your case, you're going to whack it a third each time. Again, looking up how to do it correctly, remembering that shoot collar so it heals correctly. There's a lot of resources online. If you can't find them, you simply email me, and I'll have it back to you, all the resources you need to know about rejuvenating an old apple orchard that's gotten away from you. There's a lot of resources out there, and I'd be more than happy as part of my job to shoot you those.
Okay, why don't you give your email again?
Sure. It is dstevens@wisc.edu, and Marinette is special to me. My best friend, Albert Thibodeau, is from there. And if you're from there, you probably read his father's column, Tales from the Old Timer, from Dave Thibodeau. So I love Marinette.
Excuse me. Okay. well, we do have a couple of lines open, so if you have a question, please give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, and we can also send us an email. And speaking of email, Anne in Madison emailed us. She said, thanks for your hard work caring for the Arboretum. The crab apples and lilacs are always stunning. She heard that many people had their lilacs bloom a second time this past autumn. Was that an issue at the Arboretum, and are there any long-term effects for that?
Well, that is a great question, and I have the same question for my major professor, Professor Ed, who had been out there as a curator for 50 years. I've been out there for two. And what Professor Ed told me is when we get an abundance of rain in the growing season, the lilac's actually happy. So they're going to shoot off a little bit of bloom now. Shouldn't really impact your spring flowers at all. It's just telling you, hey, I'm happy. Not a bad thing.
So it's not a bad thing. Now, I have a magnolia tree that did the same thing. Is that the same case?
It's somewhat similar, yes. Okay. Somewhat similar. It's happy. Sometimes realize, though, if we have stress, so if we had a drought and it's starting to flower, it's trying to reproduce seed quickly because it thinks the Armageddon's upon it.
Right.
So you've got to look at what happened during that growing season. We had a lot of rain, and things were happy. We had almost perfect rainfall. Unfortunately, we had high humidity, which wasn't necessarily related to the rain.
Sure. Right. Absolutely. And just to remind folks again, you're going to be doing a presentation, and it's going to be at the Garden Vision Conference on January 20th and 21st, and that will be on pruning. And there's going to be a lot of other guests there that will be talking about a number of different things. And if you're interested in going there, you want to go to their website, which is gardensvisions.info. That's I-N-F-O, and that's put on by the UW Extension over there up in, which one is that? That's Central Wisconsin, I believe it is. It's in Wausau. That's right. So if you want to do there, you want to go there, and there's a lot of speakers you'll be happy to see. We are talking with David Stevens, and he is the curator at the Longenecker Horticultural Gardens at the University of Wisconsin, Madison's Arboretum. And so if you've got any more questions, please give us a call. We'll be back after news. Well, it's Friday, so that means it's Garden Talk. Hi, Jill Najoe here. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. We're talking with David Garrison Stevens. He is the curator at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Arboretum. What questions do you have about trees or woody ornamentals or gardening in general? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Now, David, you had mentioned before we got back on the air that you've actually just received an honorary associate fellow appointment with the Department of Horticulture. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I can tell you it's an incredible honor for me being an alumni of the department. When I started May 4th, 2 years ago, the head of the department, Erwin Goldman, who's been on this show many times, offered me that very appointment. And being the kind of person I am, I waited exactly a year and a half, and then I took him up on it. So he just got that to me at the end of the year when I was actually out in Arizona visiting my 30-year-old son, Forrest. And it's quite an honor as well. So I just got it, so I don't know exactly what it means, but I know I can do research with them, and perhaps they'll even let me do a little teaching.
Okay, wonderful. Well, let's go back to the phones because we've got a lot of callers. The first person we're going to talk to is Rich. He's in Appleton. Hi, Rich. What question do you have?
I think it's pretty cool that you name your son Forrest, but
don't let him get on with
He lived in Appleton, too, so that's great.
I do my tree pruning late February, early March, but I'd like to get on it now, early January, but it's sub-zero up here, and I'm wondering if there's any detriment to pruning when it's this cold and dry out.
Well, the detriment is your fingers getting frostbite.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, so the reality is that this is the great time because there's no insects, there's no bacteria, there's no spores from fungus out there. Why we say, and you are doing it the exact right way, why we say we wait to the later winter is because that wound, you know, the tree can't do much growing, right, when it's this cold out, minus four, well, where I was this morning. So by doing it a little later, there's a wound there. It's very short because the plant's starting to grow. We're out there right now. My head horticulturist again, Stephen James Nystrand's out there. As soon as she gets warm, a little bit warmer, pruning, and then I'll try to help when I can. This is when we prune. So the winter ideal. If you have to do some in the summer, I can give you tips on that too.
Okay. Well, have fun, Rich, but keep the extremities covered. Let's go to Jerry in Hudson. Hi, Jerry. What's your question?
Hi. I bought two small tardiva shrubs actually at the Minnesota Arboretum fall sale. And I planted them in a place I thought was large enough. And in spite of neglect, they've done extremely well. They're now well over my head. And they have the, you know, the spring flowers and then summer and then the fall through the year, what's left of the flowers and stuff. I have no idea how to prune these because I'm afraid of being too aggressive with them. I don't want to cause problems with them. They're pretty big for the space they're in. So I just look at them and I whack off a little bit of the top and, you know, and then just leave them and ignore them again because they don't know.
Sure. So people who don't know what you're calling a tardiva is actually a cultivar of hydrangea paniculata, the panicle hydrangea. And thanks to Professor Ed Hassekis, we believe at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, we have the largest collection of cultivars of paniculata or hydrangea paniculata in the country. So the old one, there's been a lot of breeding done recently. When I was at grad school 26 years ago, the one we called it PG hydrangeas. That's the same thing. Over the last 26 years, there's been tremendous breeding going on, a lot of that over in the Netherlands. And I could talk an entire program just about that. So I go back to Professor Ed. He taught me when I became the curator. What he's found is we want to prune. You could do it now. We usually wait till, later in the winter or early spring when we get our incredible dedicated volunteers out there. And we're always looking for volunteers, so just contact me or our volunteer coordinator, be even better, Judy Kingsbury, and you can find her or me on our website, UW Arboretum. So back to your question, we cut it back so you'll see the new growth on the tree, or this is a tree hydrangea. It's really a shrub. We're going to take that new growth from last year and cut it back to 1 to 2 nodes. What's a node? That's where the bud is, okay? If you take it back there, Professor Ed has discovered, and I've taken it from him, that you get the most robust flowers from that because every new growth or new shoot is going to have a flower on the end. You can't overdo it. You can't underdo it if you just don't want to do it. That's fine. They're incredibly hardy, the most hardy of the hydrangeas, native to Japan again, and they flower on this year's wood. So that means if you cut it this time of year, you're not taking the buds off that were formed last year, similar to what we talked about with lilacs. Okay?
Okay.
And if another question, just shoot me a pic, shoot me an email, and I'll send you it all in writing with pictures.
Okay, Jerry, it sounds like you probably can't go wrong, whatever you decide to do. Let's talk to Travis in New London. Hi, Travis. What's your question?
Hi there. Where I live now, I have ash and elm trees in my yard. They're growing in sand. They're doing well. About 40 miles away is my hunting land, and I have ash and elm trees there, and they're growing in water. And I know that this is not good for trees. In the winter, I was thinking about going down and harvesting some of these. A lot of them are dead. The bark is falling off all the way down to the bottom. And I just wanted to know that if I harvest them, I'm not sure if they're dead because of the water or if they have a disease. There are some holes in the bark, tiny holes, round holes. It looks like maybe a bug or two has been crawling around in there. Should I even bring these home? And if I do bring them home, you know, should I, is there something I can do?
That doesn't sound like a good idea. What do you think, yeah, David?
Well, what you've got, it sounds like if it's growing in water and it hasn't, you haven't recently had a beaver dam up a stream or somebody put a hydroelectric dam in there. It sounds like the ash you have growing further north are black ash, and that's where they grow, where their feet are wet and in water. Not a problem. That's what they like. Down where you are, no doubt you've got green or white ash, and you flood those guys, and or gals, and you're going to see those go down. What's really troubling to me are the holes you're talking about. If it's on the ash, it sounds indicative of emerald ash borer. Look it up online. They won't be round. We look for D-shaped exit holes. And if the bark's already coming off, you can strip it down a little more, and you'll see the feeding galleries, and they'll be snake-like, right? Instead of up and down, they're snake-like. But better yet, just Google EAB Wisconsin, our Department of Natural Resources, Forest Health folks, Becky Gray, Kyoko Scadlin, those folks over there have some great identifiers there. And they'll also probably shoot you over to DATCAP. Melanie Walker has put out some incredible stuff there too. If you're still not sure, shoot me an email. As far as the elm, remember, elm are getting Dutch elm disease. And while they'll survive, usually for 15 to 30 years, sooner or later they succumb to it. How do they succumb to it? Beetles carry the fungus of the disease and will attack it. So that's normal at this stage in the game, ever since Dutch elm disease was discovered out east, and I could talk for a whole time about that as well. If it's not in water in the spring, those are called shiners, and that's what we go to look for morels around. So you could do those. You can move the elm, but get, again, your county DNR forester out there. They want to see if it's EAB, emerald ash borer, and they want to record it. So they'll tell you what you can do. If you're in the quarantine area, you can't go out of the quarantine area with the bark on it, or you're moving the insect, right? The larval form is under the bark.
Right. Okay. Well, good luck with that, Travis. Let's go to Janet in Oconomowoc. Hi, Janet. What question do you have?
Actually, I have two. The first one is, I've noticed a lot of trees in my neighborhood, including some of my fruit trees this year, where the leaves dried up in the fall and died, but they haven't fallen off. And I believe some of the other trees are silver maples. They almost look like in the spring when the buds are starting to come out. So I wondered why they did that this year. And then my second question is, I have yews in front of my garage, and the deer have come year after year and stripped off as many of the leaves as they can reach. So it's like the front half of the bush is dead, but the back half is still growing strong. So I was wondering if I cut off all those front dead branches, would I kill the bush, or would it regrow?
Well, it depends on what the bush is there. So if you've got something like an evergreen, an arborvitae, taxus, thuja, etc., you can't prune into the dead area and expect it to come back. So, again, just shoot me a picture of it. I'll identify it for you and tell you how to do it. What I can tell you right now is that you've got the wrong plant in the wrong place. If you've got deer population like that, you're going to either have to fence it off in the winter, which is what we do with most of our arborvitae and other things that deer, we call them deer candy, or you're just going to expect that to occur, or put a deer-resistant plant there. If you go to University of Wisconsin, horticulture now, Laura Jull is somebody in landscape plants, took over for Professor Ed many years ago. She, I believe, has a great publication through Extension that you can access for free online, and she'll tell you deer-proof plants, quote-unquote, versus things that aren't. Remember, if we have a harsh winter and your deer population's high, I don't care how deer-proof it is, they're looking for food.
Right.
So I don't know if I got your other questions, but if I didn't, just shoot them to me in an email. I love this kind of stuff. I'll get right back to you.
The leaves not falling off the trees?
Yeah, so the leaves not falling off the trees. Love that idea. So you can see that kind of concept if we have a frost, or actually a hard freeze, which is what we had here this year. We didn't slowly succumb to winter, right? It was very warm in the fall, and then wham, bam, we had a heavy freeze, never having really frost before. So that'll kill the leaves right where they are, and they tend to persist on the tree. However, you said in your silver maple you saw them flush as if it was a spring. That goes back to the really nice summer we had of rain, and in forestry we call it Lammas growth. So a second flush of growth in the fall. That can be a good thing. If you're in forestry, maybe you get a couple more inches of growth and a little more diameter on it. With the way we had it this year, that Lammas growth was immediately slammed by that freeze, so it didn't do much. If we continue to have those kind of things happen over the next 10 years, maybe an issue, maybe not. Shoot me that email, and I'll tell you why you should probably remove that silver maple.
Okay. All right, Janet, good luck with that. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Sue in Mkwanago. She's got a pruning question. Sue?
Oh, hello. You are just the best guest on this program. I've learned so much listening. I've tuned in late, but I have a question. Last summer, I bought some drift ground cover roses, and my question to you is, how do I prune them, or do I have to prune them this coming spring, and how do I handle them, you know, later this year?
Sure. First, thank you for the compliment. I'm not going to take that, though, to head. There's a lot more brilliant people that have been on here. So drift, I'm not super familiar with. I'll tell you, I'm just looking it up now. Roses, there's a lot of different types, things that are grafted, hybrid teas, things like Rosa rugosa that we have the largest collection of around, and we like them because they're deer-proof. In general, if it's not one of these hybrid teas, and I'm seeing drift roses are not, they're considered low maintenance, and they will reward you with endless color all season long, and that's coming from the people who bred it. So that tells me you really don't have to worry about that. If they start to get overgrown, we recommend, we being Ed Hazelkiss and myself, remember he was my professor who taught me how to do this, we will take back to the ground, again, roughly a quarter to a third of the oldest and biggest canes. And what that's going to do is rejuvenate them to flush with younger ones, right? The younger ones are more vigorous. Look at my kids next to me, the old guy, right? They're more vigorous than I am. In general, though, these were really bred to really not have to be dealt with in that fashion. If you see over time they're getting overgrown, didn't flower as good as last year, even though you watered them or whatever, treated them the same, then you can go in and do that renewal pruning is what it's called.
Okay. Those are some beautiful roses. I really enjoy those. Let's go to Dot in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Dot. What's going on?
Hi. I have a question for you.
Sure. Go ahead.
In some of my indoor plants, the soil has a bit of a whitish residue. I don't know if it's mold or what it might be.
What do you think, David?
Where are you? What?
In Chippewa Falls.
Chippewa Falls. So I'm not familiar with your water quality. Do you have is your water hard or soft?
Well, we have a well.
Right? Okay. So have you ever had it tested? Are you on limestone? Do you know?
Am I on what?
Limestone. So is the predominant stone under in your region, is it limestone or like where I am up in the bluffs, we have quartzite granite? What I'm getting at is like here in Madison, the biggest issue for our water is it's high in lime, right? Calcium. And that will create a white sheen on the top and also on the bottom. So prior to doing all these other things I'm talking about, I was a greenhouse manager at Agricetus, anyway, a large greenhouse facility in Middleton. We had such problems with the lime in the water that we had to install a reverse osmosis system to get rid of it. Okay, so without seeing it, and it sounds like a houseplant, that's the buildup. Sometimes we call it salt builds up. So the things you can do, it seems like a waste, but you might go to your local whatever grocery store, get some distilled water on occasion, and flush it out. Again, if you want to send me a picture of it to my email, I'll take a look and tell you if you've got a disease growing, like a mold, or If you've got Lyme, if it's a mold, again, I'm going to direct you right over to Brian Huddleston at the Plant Diagnostic Lab on campus.
Okay, good luck, Dot. I know I've seen that before in house plants with that from the watering. Phyllis in Clark County, what's on your mind?
I have a grove of white pine and red pine that's overdue to be thinned. It was planted, and I'm guessing maybe 15, 20 years ago, with some oak in there, and I don't see a lot of oak anymore. But anyway, I'm looking for someone to do that, and I got a great long list of people who do that kind of thing, and I'm finding out that if they're a larger company, they only want large stands, you know.
Yep.
And the other thing is, I'm wondering, how do I evaluate the quality of the work that they do? I mean, are they going to butcher it, or are they going to thin it in a manner that it would continue to grow as it should? Can you just give me some tips on that?
You bet I can. So remember, before I came over to do the horticulture hat, I worked in forestry for almost 14 years. You're the exact same as the earlier caller. The way things are put in, walnuts and oaks, traditionally is we put them in a line. You'd put your oak followed next to it by a pine, either Pinus strobus, which is the white pine, or Pinus resinosa, which is the red pine, both native to our state. They were planted as trainers, right? They wanted to get the oaks to go up fast and straight, naturally prune off the lower limbs. You're well overdue at 15 years, and what you're coming into is the same thing I came into when I had to get some of my plantings thinned. It's called in forestry pre-commercial, right? It's too small for them to use it to sell it as pulpwood, to sell it as saw timber, etc. So what you want to do, again, every county right now has a DNR, Department of Natural Resources, forester. And they will come out and take a look at it for you. That's what they're paid for. You're not going to pay them anything. That's their job. They love doing it. That's why they went into forestry. They're going to look at it, tell you what to do. And there is a list, right? They don't come up with it. There's a list online of accredited forestry individuals who will come out and do the right job for you. You just don't go out to the grocery store and run into somebody in the parking lot and he says he's got a chainsaw and he can come out here. No, these people are really accredited, right? I've got accreditation in using chainsaws. Everybody at the Arboretum who operates a chainsaw had to go through numerous classes. I consider it one of the most dangerous items we have in our toolbox for pruning. Done right, it's phenomenal. So again, look up online or send me an email, and I will tell you who the forester is. There's a good chance I know him personally, okay?
Okay, Phyllis. I think you got a lot of good advice there. We've only got a few minutes left, but Pat on Facebook says that he or she, I'm not sure, has too many sumac shrubs spreading from a slope area into their yard. Is there a way to permanently remove these because they're sumacs. I mean.
Right. That's what sumacs do.
They sure do.
And being at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, where we have the first prairie restoration in the world, the Curtis Prairie, yes, that's one of the big issues, is encroachment from woody ornamentals, right? I love the trees. They fear the trees, okay? Again, I come from an organic background. You can keep mowing it back, and you're slowly kill it back, but that's also renews them. You're going to have to go, I hate to tell you, to a chemical, and it's usually Garlon. Again, send me an email, and I'll tell you everything you want to know.
Okay. Well, yeah, good luck with those. I have the same problem. We've been talking with David Garrison-Stevens. He is the curator of the Long & Necker Horticultural Gardens at the UW-Madison's Arboretum. He'll be a speaker at the UW Extension Garden Visions Conference on January 20th and 21st. For more information, go on to the website for the conference, gardenvisions.info. Thanks to Brandy Funk for on-air production and to Dave Potras for technical direction. On Monday, we're going to talk with an eyeglass specialist about the effects of long-term use of blue light for our vision. And we'll also talk to a researcher about exercise and cancer patients. Hope you can join us for that. I'm Jill Nadeau. I've been sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network.